Welcome to a Bowden Education podcast, and in this podcast we'll be discussing the idea and importance of a psychologically safe school with Adrian Bethune. Welcome, Adrian. Talk to us about where you came across or how you came across the concept of a psychologically safe school.
So I was reading a Harvard Business Review kind of article online, saw it on Twitter, and then I tweeted because it made me reflect on teaching through this kind of psychological safe lens. And I tweeted and just said that I think there's a distinct lack of psychological safety in the UK education system. Because it's predicated on fear, which halts risk-taking, creativity, learning and well-being. And I just said, you know, let's create more psychologically safe schools in 2020. Growth mindset isn't just for kids. That was kind of what my tweet was about.
So what you're saying is that you definitely feel that there's a distinct challenge, perhaps, shall we say, within the school environment that makes us feel unsafe psychologically, perhaps as teachers within a school?
Yeah, I think because I retrained to be a teacher, so I'd had, you know, three or four other jobs in different industries, and then I came into teaching. So having, you know, the last job I had before becoming a teacher was I worked in music publishing. Mm-hmm. And then to come into a kind of school environment, particularly a primary school, where my memory of primary school was very safe, it was very relaxed, it was very fun. And then to come into this environment where it was very pressurized, really intense, a lot of scrutiny, a lot of observation. And I just couldn't believe how intense it felt. And I would say, yeah, definitely from a psychological safety perspective, I felt on edge a lot of the time, even though physically I was completely safe. Mm-hmm. And that's been my experience from like day one, and then speaking to other teachers and in other schools, that kind of comes up as a theme. And when you look at statistics from well-being surveys like the Education Support Partnership, mm-hmm. you know, teachers experience a much higher level of stress and anxiety compared to, say, the national average. So, yeah, I think a lack of psychological safety in education in the UK is quite prevalent.
And in a way, that's an absolutely crazy situation to be in when we're in a nurturing profession, whereby we talk and spend a lot of time thinking about how we're making our children safe. Indeed, it's in the teacher standards. If you want to go down that road, won't dwell on that. But it's about keeping children safe. And we talk a lot about physical safety and social, emotional and psychological safety with children. Yet our own teachers are feeling like this. And at the same time, you've come from somewhere like the music business, which perhaps externally you'd see as highly pressurized and not such a nice place to be, and yet you've found exactly the opposite. It's quite worrying.
I mean the music industry, my job had kind of peaks of stress, so there were certain times of year that were kind of crunch times, like setting budgets end of year, those like negotiating new contracts. But outside of those crunch times, there was a lot of just calm, relaxed, getting on with your work. Whereas, you know, my experience of teaching is literally from the moment you're in school, you're doing stuff, it's intense pretty much all the time, it feels like. And yeah, you're absolutely right that the system we work in is complete bonkers. Like, it is completely counterproductive to what we want for the teaching staff, but also importantly for the children. Like, having an unsafe psychological working environment hampers creativity, it hampers learning, it hampers well-being. And those are all things that we want to be, and risk-taking. Those are all things we want to be cultivating in our schools. And it's not to say that it can't be done and that there were schools, even in the system, where staff report high levels of psychological safety. But I would say they buck the trend. They're operating safe spaces despite the environment, the kind of bigger educational system that they operate in.
And then, of course, we look at the wider picture beyond this, and we also see statistics not only around health and well-being of teachers, but about the recruitment and retention. So that it's no big secret now, is there, that the recruitment into teaching is becoming much more challenging, and retaining teachers within the system is quite difficult, with, I think it's just over a third now, statistics are pointing out, that are leaving in the first 5 years. So it seems, again, if we can't look after our teachers, they are going to leave. And so it seems well worth investing in this notion.
Yeah, definitely. You know, just to that Harvard Business Review, in terms of the definition of psychological safety, I'm sure there are a lot more scientific and in-depth explanations, but it says psychological safety is essentially the belief you won't be punished when you make a mistake. Mm. And then I saw a tweet today by Dr. Tim O'Brien, who's professor of psychology at the Institute of Education, and he said, "Hyper accountability eats well-being for breakfast." And I think, ultimately, that is the problem. Like, all state-maintained schools in the UK operate in an environment of hyper accountability. So the teachers are responsible, and the schools are responsible pretty much 100% for the academic attainment their students get, regardless of, you know, that student's background. That's not taken into account. And I'm not talking about making excuses because someone comes from a challenging background or whatever. It's the fact that there is only so much we can control, but we are 100% accountable for those children. And that's not fair. And that in itself undermines psychological safety when you're operating in an environment that feels unfair.
I think, of course, for a teacher, a mistake is, when you're talking about the definition, and I'd noted exactly the same, when you talk of teachers making a mistake, to that, it's not a mistake as akin to maybe if you were doing other jobs. This is kind of children that aren't meeting expected, that didn't quite get there, that didn't quite get there expected in their SATs when the results come in. Mm. Teachers see those as mistakes, if you like, don't they?
Yeah, and the article, the Harvard Business Review article, basically said that when you feel psychologically unsafe, you've made a mistake, whatever that mistake is, the primitive nature of kind of some structures of our brain translate that as a kind of life and death situation, like we're being threatened or attacked by a predator. That's essentially what happens when we feel psychologically unsafe. We go into that fight-flight mode. And you're right, 9 times out of 10 in teaching, it's not a life and death situation. It's, you know, a child or a few children haven't quite made the grade, or it can even be that because over the last few years, parents have been given a lot more say and power in their children's educations, which on the one hand is a really positive thing. You're trying to get parents involved and give them a voice. On the other hand, it means that a teacher can send out, say, a newsletter for their class, and it's got, say, 2 typos in it. And then one parent, or maybe a couple of parents, will write to the head teacher and complain about that. And suddenly something really minor is blown up into something huge. And that is all of those little things that chip away at teachers' confidence and their sense of professionalism. And it's all just counterproductive. We want our teachers to feel safe and valued so that they can pass on that to the children, so they feel safe and valued, and they can take risks, they can explore, they can make mistakes, they can understand that that is all part of learning, and it's absolutely essential.
And I think as well, over years, moving on to talk maybe about how we see achievement. I think the notion of achievement and what a teacher has achieved is down to what the children have achieved, and that's an extraordinarily narrow field around have they achieved reading, writing and maths. And for some children, they haven't achieved what they might be expected for their age to achieve in one of those subjects, but they've achieved an awful lot for that person or child. But also they could be achieving phenomenal things in other areas of the curriculum.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, it's a very narrow focus, and it's high stakes on that very narrow focus, which, you know, is not helpful. I went to an event yesterday in London, and it was partly the book launch of Professor Richard Layard, his new book called Can We Be Happier?
Yeah.
And his big argument in that book, he's got a whole section on education, and he was interviewed in a newspaper recently, and I'll just read the quote. He says, if we take school teaching as a profession, we know that the most important predictor of whether a young person will be a happy adult is not the grades they get, but whether they're happy at school. It would make a huge difference if we could get away from the focus on exams as the main purpose of education. And in the book, he kind of expands on that and says that, you know, essentially, we treasure what we measure. And he firmly believes that schools should, as they do in the Netherlands, routinely measure student well-being. Because, yeah, if we valued that, if we said a school is successful because, yeah, they're getting good grades, plus their children are kind of flourishing in that environment, then that is an excellent school in my mind. You can get good grades and absolutely your children can be really not enjoying the experience. You can get good grades and the teachers can be absolutely miserable. But a flourishing school is one where children are doing their best academically and they feel valued, they feel safe, they feel happy in that environment.
And I often, in my initial teacher education, mm-hmm. background, I've had conversations many times with students where I ask them what we might say is a really silly question, mm-hmm. but I always ask them that, how many times have you ever seen a child taken out of an English class to have PE intervention because they can't throw and catch?
Yeah.
And they always laugh and roll their eyes, but actually then we unpick it and roll reverse that children are taken out of music and they're taken out of PE to do more English, something that they perhaps really don't enjoy, they're not very good at, and we're punishing them to do more and more. And how are we enabling them to grow and flourish and indeed enjoy their education and maybe mm-hmm. even grow and develop in something that they're really, really good at.
Yeah. We have this twisted concept that the way to get children to improve at, say, English or maths is to get them to do loads of English and maths.
Yeah, do more.
Yeah, which, you know, on the one hand, neuroscience does show that if you repeatedly practice something, 9 times out of 10, you will improve at it. But that doesn't take into account a child's motivation or also other psychological factors, like actually if you're taking them out of a P lesson to do extra maths, they might actually start to lose confidence in maths. You know, it feels counterintuitive, but, you know, they're thinking, I'm not good at maths, no one else is being taken out, I'm rubbish at maths, and that immediately makes learning harder in maths. There's other research that shows that actually, you know, it's a really good example about PE. In some research, if you get children to do less learning, say, and more physical education or more physical activity, they actually learn more in those shorter lessons and make far greater progress. And that feels counterintuitive, like actually we teach them less English but they get better at English because they're doing more PE. But that's just knowing and understanding how the human body and brain works. Like actually the more physically active we are, the better our neurons communicate with each other, the better our brains produce a protein called BDNF, which is like miracle growth for the brain. You know, it's a whole host of things that happen through physical activity. But like you said, the statistics show we're teaching less PE in primary school. Schools have cut back over the last 10 years the amount of playtime minutes that, that children have. We're doing so many things that the research shows is just like bonkers to do. And we're doing it in the name of progress and learning, but actually it's not the way to go.
And at the same time, all of that additional time in the playground, additional time in PE is really good for children and adults, indeed, if we're exercising and so on, our own well-being and our mental capacity.
Yeah, yeah, so, definitely. And also, you know, there are studies on creativity that show on problem-solving tasks, it can be really beneficial to have a break. You know, it even like experts, so like people that work in Google and Apple, like these top-performing companies, yes, they probably work long hours and really hard, but they also, part of the working environment is it's punctuated with lots of breaks, because studies show we often do better on problem-solving tasks when we have a break from the problem. It's almost like your brain starts to work out and figure stuff out by itself. And so that's another reason why playtime and kind of non-academic parts of the day are really important.
So moving on, and I'm going to say the O word. So do you really think that this lying behind all of this and our move in the curriculum and doing less and having less playtime, doing less PE, do you think that is driven a lot down, is it down to Ofsted?
There's certainly a key part of this hyper accountability system, definitely. Like, they're not the, you know, a huge responsibility lies at the door of the DfE, the Department for Education, because ultimately what they say is important is what Ofsted will inspect for, and it's what's it's the hoops that then schools try and jump through. So yeah, Ofsted definitely play a part, and you know, it doesn't help. What are we on in the last 10 years? Is this the fourth or fifth inspection framework?
Yeah.
I mean, that in itself makes you feel psychologically unsafe, because you're like, okay, what's the focus now? Like, when I started teaching in my RQT year, and it was literally the first term after my NQT year had finished, we had an Ofsted inspection. And back then, I don't know if it's different now, RQTs were, they weren't even called RQTs, they were just teachers. Yeah. And I was judged the same way. And this is when lessons were judged as good or outstanding based on 20-minute snapshots. I got 2 requires improvement judgments because I was talking too much, apparently. You know, it was a science lesson as well. It was the first, you know. So now that's out of fashion, as in the kind of talk less, get them to do more and blah, blah. Now it's actually direct instruction, teacher talk, which is in favour. But all of that change, it's just like teachers don't know whether they're coming or going and what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. And that that chips away at your professionalism. We are professionals. We've done a postgrad qualification. We've gone through a kind of, well, an additional 1 year induction process, NQT year. We should be trusted to know how to teach our children. And I don't feel the Ofsted framework process helps with that. I think it undermines teachers' professionalism and confidence.
Yeah, and I think if you start drawing comparisons internationally to places that are often quoted, such as Finland, they have no inspection regime. Therefore, their goalposts are not moving like our goalposts move. So their teachers are teaching based upon their knowledge, their understanding, their research, and their very thorough education. But when you've got goalposts moving, it does become, and you can completely sympathise in a way with head teachers. That it's, what box have we got to tick now? What game are we playing this time around? And then panicking about getting the game right.
And as part of that, there's a whole kind of industry around preparing for Ofsted and it's all about curriculum now. The number of conferences and consultants offering advice on curriculum and knowledge organisers and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That again just sends people into this little panic, like, I went to a school and they have knowledge organisers, should we have knowledge organisers? And it's like, you start to doubt yourself and what you're doing, like how you've been doing stuff for the last 5 to 10 years, you suddenly feel is a load of rubbish and you have to redo everything. It's not helpful.
And I think another unhelpful one, I saw some tweets over the last day or so about Ofsted saying that schools have got to stop playing, and I think this is mainly aimed at secondary schools, but have got to stop playing the league table game and trying to get their place in the league tables, which I found a fascinating statement. So I completely agree with the statement, but get rid of league tables then, because while they're there, schools are going to play the game because they've got no choice to play the game.
Yeah, there are. So I'm not entirely sure where I sit on the whole Ofsted thing, as in, like, some people are staunchly they should be abolished and other people, you know, I don't see a problem inherently with having an inspectorate. The problem is the high stakes nature of those inspections. The problem is, can you seriously make a really accurate judgment on just essentially what is 1.5 days, because they start writing their report on the second half of the day. What I would do, if it was possible, would be to ban the publishing of league tables so that that's not possible. So schools can't compare themselves in this ranking system. I would ban the publishing of Ofsted judgments. So I don't think it should be published, this outstanding, good, requires improvement, whatever, because I don't think that's helpful. It's just another way of league tabling schools. Essentially, another thing that undermines psychological safety is competition. Is competition, because it becomes then this survival of the fittest, which again kicks in your primeval fight flight response. Whereas what we need, what is the most sustainable model, is schools collaborating rather than competing, is schools sharing resources, because we are teaching at a time where there's a lack of resources and funding. So we need schools to come together to help each other out. What we don't want is schools trying to get one up on each other and trying to game the system, because it just sells kids short ultimately.
Absolutely. So moving forward, because I think quite often, as we say, head teachers are in fear of Ofsted. We've seen reports this week of a head teacher saying that she's left because she just can't put up with it anymore, driven out by Ofsted. However, I also think sometimes head teachers can use Ofsted as an excuse to get their staff to do things that they'd like them to do. So Ofsted expect you to. Reason. So there's all of that going on and all of this sort of lesson observation. How, in your mind, do you think that heads or schools, therefore, can move from this sort of compliance culture, this surveillance, monitoring, into being a much more psychologically safe environment, where then things will improve, I'm with no doubt, because people are feeling safer, more creative, and they flourish. What are the steps?
I think ultimately, to create that kind of culture in a school, I think ultimately it kind of has to be a top-down approach. And what I mean by that, it's really down to leaders to create the culture of safety in the schools that they lead. And that is really important when the wider system is one of hyper accountability. So leaders have to be quite maverick and brave in a way to kind of not bow down to the pressures of Ofsted and not try and tick boxes that they know are meaningless. So you need quite courageous leaders in schools. Ultimately, they need to see one of their most important jobs is protecting their staff from outside pressures. So rather than some head teachers and leaders that just pass it down, you know, they feel intense pressure, so they just push it down onto their staff. You need leaders to kind of protect their staff from that and just let them get on with teaching. They need to trust their teachers and their teaching staff, which means not monitoring the life out of them.
Mm-hmm.
The culture of trust has to be one of, if there is some kind of observational framework, be it lesson studies or learning walks, whatever, teachers have to believe that they won't be punished when they make a mistake, to go back to that definition of psychological safety. Yeah. So if there is something a head teacher or leader, senior leader, doesn't quite agree with or whatever, one of the approaches in the Harvard Business Review was about being curious. So replace blame with curiosity. So yeah. Just ask questions. So, you know, in that lesson when you did X, Y, Z, can you explain your motivation or why you chose to do it that way? And it might be the teacher says, do you know what, I just completely messed up, I didn't mean to do that, my plan said this. And or they might explain it and it suddenly makes sense, you know. But that culture of curiosity rather than blame is massively important. Other things they can do is ask for feedback on their leadership. So often observations just go one way. You know, senior leaders get to observe teaching staff and no one asks the teaching staff, well, how good are your leaders? What do they do well and what could they improve? So I think there has to be a culture of what in music publishing we call 360 degree feedback. You get feedback from kind of everyone around you, but the purpose is to improve. It's not meant to be critical. It's meant to be like, how can we as an organization improve what we do? And the last thing, there are other things, but the last thing I think is measure psychological safety as part of an annual staff wellbeing survey. Like measure it, see how well your team are doing in terms of psychological safety. Do they feel safe? If so, great. If not, you need to work on that as a school.
And going back to your feedback point, absolutely agree. I think we do too much feedback and it should be actually far more around a professional conversation, a learning conversation.
Yeah.
Than feedback, and it should be two way, not a delivery of. And I think that would be one huge step towards people feeling safer, and that it is a learning process, not a judgment process.
Yeah.
So, just finishing off, one quote that the article actually starts off with, and it says there's no team without trust.
Mm.
So perhaps a message to schools and to leadership teams are that you can't run an effective school team, a team of teachers, if you haven't created trust.
Yeah, I completely agree. We've got to trust our colleagues. We've got to trust our leaders as well. And we've got to also trust that when people do make mistakes, which they will do, trust that they will be able to learn from it and trust that they will be able to help put it right. And sometimes that means kind of letting go, like not trying to rescue someone or not trying to fix it for them, like just step back and just trust that, that the right things will happen if you give it the space to happen.
Brilliant. Well, I think we've explored a lot to give people listening a good amount of food for thought about how to operate and what how they might approach or even make some changes to the way that they operate within schools. So thank you very much, Adrian, for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.